Randall had a personal tie to Tillerson. They had belonged to the same marching band fraternity at the University of Texas. Randall played trumpet, Tillerson played drums. They had both been engineering students in the marching band, that is, double nerds. Randall was a couple of years ahead of Tillerson at UT, and the men had not known each other well at the time, but the shared history reinforced their professional relationship when Randall became a Houston-based broker of oil and gas properties. At industry and university luncheons, Tillerson and Randall would occasionally run into each other and catch up on oil and gas matters or reminisce about university days. Around 2007, Randall had suggested that Tillerson invite Bob Simpson on a hunting trip so the two men could get to know each other better. Tillerson agreed, and he and Simpson spent a few days shooting together on ExxonMobil's vast ranch near Alice, Texas. They got along. Each had been reared in unglamorous circumstances in rural Texas and had now achieved transforming wealth and success. Each had put down roots in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and reveled in the region's history and ranch culture. Each regarded himself as a disciplined leader devoted to operational perfection. Their corporations occasionally partnered on deals and worked compatibly. After his Fairmont Whistler Bar summit with Simpson in late July, Jack Randall telephoned Tillerson.
"Rex, I need to come see you," he said. "It's very, very important. It's very confidential."
Tillerson invited him to Irving to meet in his office. When Randall arrived on August 6th, he explained that Bob Simpson was thinking about a strategic combination between XTO and ExxonMobil. Might ExxonMobil be interested?
"Yes, I think we'll be interested," Tillerson answered. "Let me take some time to soak on it."
In 1976, as a young Exxon engineer on his second assignment in East Texas, Rex Tillerson was asked to work on a drilling technique known as hydraulic fracturing, which employs pressurized fluids to shatter rocks and unlock natural gas buried in complex geological formations. The drilling and engineering problems he wrestled with anticipated the shale gas boom that undergirded XTO's success. In part because of his early direct experience, Tillerson felt he understood the unconventional gas business. Not everyone in or around ExxonMobil thought Tillerson had the analysis right, however. For most of Tillerson's career, the exploitation of American onshore natural gas beds had not been a major priority for Exxon and other international oil companies. Alaska's large gas fields attracted their attention, but the regulatory and political approvals necessary to pipe the gas to the lower 48 continually eluded them. In Lee Raymond's era, the big opportunities in oil and gas seemed to lie overseas, in new territories opened up by the Cold War's end, in Saudi Arabia, and in ocean waters, where a corporation like ExxonMobil could bring technological advantage to bear. For ExxonMobil, apart from its large projects in Qatar and Aceh, managing natural gas was often a byproduct of exploiting oil. Natural gas collocated or associated with oil reserves in deep water and elsewhere could be a challenge because the gas was often stranded at the oil wellhead. There was no economical way to pipe it to a customer. One way to dispose of such stranded gas was to burn or flare it. ExxonMobil flared gas routinely at its offshore African wells. That exacerbated greenhouse gas emissions from oil operations, however, and it wasted a natural resource that might otherwise fuel, say, Nigeria's moribund electricity sector. In some places, international oil companies, including ExxonMobil, built plants to extract from stranded gas commercial products known as gas liquids. In other cases, they built plants to create liquefied natural gas that could be shipped globally. The focus had been on creating additional value, and as climate change worries rose, reducing pollution from associated gas worldwide, not searching for new freestanding supply at home. Shell, Chevron, and BP largely followed similar strategies. They ignored onshore, complex gas reserves in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere. They invested instead in liquefied natural gas. LNG could soak up both associated offshore gas and bring some large, stranded, non-associated gas fields to market, such as the North Field in Qatar, while gradually creating a global gas market that looked reassuringly familiar to the free-flowing, globally integrated oil market. For years, to the international majors, the kinds of Texas and Oklahoma gas fields that Bob Simpson had scooped up while building XTO after 1986, and the kind of field in East Texas that Tillerson had been assigned to early in his own career, looked picayune, expensive to produce, and of doubtful long-term profitability. Still, ExxonMobil and other majors fiddled around some in these American gas fields over the years. They took leases and they drilled wells, but they did not invest at anything like the scale of their overseas LNG and other gas liquids projects. Lee Raymond had declared in 2003 that American natural gas production had probably peaked. The Energy Department predicted that the United States might run out of domestic gas supplies, which were used mainly for heating and electric power generation, in just two decades. Alan Greenspan, educated by private conversations with Lee Raymond, urged Congress to consider fast-tracking the construction of liquefied natural gas import terminals around the United States to address this coming, widely predicted gas shortfall. As it turned out, Lee Raymond had been wrong. Within a few years of his declaration, because of the emergence of unconventional gas drilling techniques that proved cost-effective, the Energy Department revised its forecasts and now predicted that the United States had about a century's worth of natural gas reserves. ExxonMobil and its international competitors missed this motherlode lying beneath American soil.